Why did you sleep on a Batman pillow in the Bob Marshall Wilderness?
I was asked to go into the mountains to take care of grayling eggs, spent a month alone in the wilderness because after the success of Indian Creek, I became known as the world's foremost fish egg babysitter. And this time I was the father of a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old. And I thought at first that the two boys could go with me and spend the month in the wilderness. We'd have a gigantic camp out, but it's full of grizzly bears. My wife and the Forest Service thought better of that plan, and I went by myself. And my youngest son, Aiden, gave me his Batman pillow because he truly believes in the superhero's power, and he thought that would help keep me safe out there. I'm not sure he likes that story being told now that he's 19.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western U.S. Our funding comes from public radio members and Humanities Montana. I'm Cherie Newman. Pete Fromm is here. He's the author of the memoir Indian Creek Chronicles, several novels, and a collection of stories. We're talking today about his second memoir, The Names of the Stars, A Life in the Wilds. That month you spent in the Bob Marshall Wilderness, as you said, was your second fish-watching gig. How does a person get a fish babysitting gig?
Desperation from the fish egg owners. The first time at Indian Creek, it was the Idaho Fish and Game trying to restart salmon runs that had been damaged by all the dams on the Columbia and the Snake. And they came up with a plan to put 2.5 million salmon eggs in a channel diverted from Indian Creek and then dropping back into the Selway River. And then they realized we need somebody to spend the winter with them to make sure they don't freeze solid. So the only requirement for the job was that you're willing to spend 7 months alone in a tent in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness area and that you can chop ice off a waterfall for 5 minutes a morning. A friend of mine told me that they were looking for somebody and they needed them right now. And I'd been reading too many Mountain Man books and I thought that sounded perfect. So I called up and got the job. Once they realized I had no experience doing anything, didn't know how to run a chainsaw, they didn't care by that point. They just said, "You're good to go. Good luck."
It was kind of a last minute hire.
Yes.
Well, in this case, it wasn't salmon eggs, it was grayling, and here's what you wrote about grayling. Native to the Arctic, two small populations of grayling were left behind by the last ice age, one in Michigan, now extinct, and the other one in the high valley of Montana's Big Hole River. But we're talking about a month that you spent in the Bob Marshall Wilderness, which is nowhere near the Big Hole River. So why introduce grayling to a river where they've never been? Didn't that make them into an invasive species?
Very good question, one I wondered about myself. And the North Fork of the Sun was originally fishless, pretty much. It was cut off by waterfalls. And over the years, they'd put brook trout and rainbows and cutthroats in. There may have been cutthroats originally in there. But they were so worried about the Big Hole grayling fishery becoming listed as a endangered species, and then the feds would come in and take over, and apparently nobody was eager for that to happen. So they thought if they could get another river population going, you can put them in lakes, and they're all over the state that way. But they wanted a river population going, so they kind of have a backup for the Big Hole population. As it turned out, most of them just washed down to Gibson Reservoir anyway, and they had another lake population. But yeah, it's from everything I learned in school here in the wildlife program. As soon as you start messing around that way, it rarely winds up for the good.
Sometimes it seems like we haven't learned anything in the last 100 years. Well, during the 7 months that you were in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, as you said, you were living in a tent. You had to use a chainsaw to saw all your own wood and find your own food or or take it in. I mean, you were basically snowed in there for all winter. But you had kind of deluxe accommodations on this gig.
Luxury. I was in a Forest Service Wilderness Guard station at Gates Creek, and Forest Service loaned the fishing game the cabin, and they packed me in with a mule train so I could take pretty much as much as I wanted in the way of food and supplies. And so it rained an awful lot that month, and I was high and dry in my cabin and could walk around. It was pretty sweet, and it was only for a month too. The only real complicating factor throughout the whole time were the bears.
Because you had to walk down a trail that was also used by the bears.
Yeah, I was pretty much walking down their trail. It was end of May, beginning of June, and the bears were following the elk around to pick off their calves when they were just born. And originally the plan had been to leave the fish eggs within a mile or so of the cabin, but they just couldn't find any good sites for them. And so instead, the eggs were 5 miles from the cabin, and so I did a 10-mile walk every day to check on the eggs, and saw black bears or grizzly bears frequently, not every day, but heard them, which is much more frightening than seeing them. When you can't see them, but they can hear them warning you off, it got a little tense. And thinking of having, if I had brought my boys in, like my original plan, it would have been deadly.
Wet, cold, miserable, and deadly. Yeah. Probably Rose and the Forest Service had a good idea there.
Yeah, I hate to admit it, but they were right.
So let's hear a passage in which a couple of those bears were kind of having a confrontation over an elk carcass. But first, explain what the Hansel and Gretel stretch is.
It was a stretch of the trail up above the river. It was about a 15-year-old burn, so it had repopulated with lodgepole pine, and they grew up within inches of each other. They were 12 feet tall, about. Their branches and needles were woven in with each other. There was an impenetrable wall. You couldn't see. The trail width was maybe 3 feet wide, and that was as far as you could see. And with the wind blowing, which it always was, the trees are rustling together, so you couldn't hear well through there either. And I started calling it to myself the Hansel and Gretel stretch because it just reminded me of those two kids lost in the forest. You know, there were grizzly tracks there all the time, and I tried to make noise going through, but it was a blind spot, you know, made the hair on the back of my neck stand up every time I went through it twice a day. Crossing Headquarters Creek, climbing up out of the Pack Bridge's dip, I make the Ridgetop Trail, the river a silver wrinkle below me, the latest fires having cleared out this whole stretch. An osprey glides down the river, too close to the goose pair, whose nest sits high atop a broken snag. They launch out, chasing the osprey down the river cut, honking and flapping for all they're worth, one circling back to the nest, the other in pursuit all the way around the bend, out of sight. I can't imagine an osprey as much of a threat to their eggs, their chicks, but still, safety first. I plod on, getting close to the Hansel and Gretel stretch, that bogeyman bend where my entire world condenses to the few feet around me. But still out in the open, the hairs on the back of my neck go up, my shoulders jumping in a shiver. It's hard being sure what you hear while walking out in the wild. All the close little noises, the rustle of clothes, the tread of feet against rock and stone, twig and needle, the wind, the water, blocking out others. But still, I stop dead, turning my head this way and that, straining to hear. And there it is again, no mistake, what I haven't heard in 17 years, a roar in the wilderness. I turn toward it, facing the river, the canyon. On the steep hill of the other side, in the low scrub of new growth, the few blackened points of the snags, they're not hard to pick out. Maybe 200 yards away, the drop and climb of the river cut putting them nearly at eye level, a pair of grizzlies, one wrestling with something behind a charred log, the other standing back, moving in, then away. 30 yards above them, a cow elk paces, watching their every move. The bigger bear, the one behind the log, lifts its head, tugging backward, and the hind leg of an elk calf tilts up, then flops back down. The smaller bear, which seems full size itself, inches closer while the big bear's head is down, until, without warning, the big grizzly bursts out, hurdling the log, barreling toward the smaller bear, front legs spread wide, hair bristled out, a massive, terrifying rush that steals my breath from across a river. I've heard of men standing still in the face of these charges, waiting for the bear to veer off at that last instant, knowing most are false charges, and I wonder what flows through their veins, or if they simply froze, only later coming up with a theory to explain their failure to move a single muscle. The smaller bear knows what to do, tripping over itself in full-scale retreat. The big bear, really it should be the huge bear, and the slightly less huge bear, doesn't bother giving chase. Instead, another roar drifts across the river to me. The big bear stomps once, then turns back, climbing across the log it had leapt over before, and lowers its head into whatever's left of the calf. The less huge bear circles back in. Above them, the cow calls to her calf, that plaintive, throaty chirp. Neither bear so much as looks in her direction. The next time the bigger bear lifts its head, I have my binos out, the red of blood clear on its muzzle. It pulls up strips of something, intestines maybe. The cow calls. The other bear shifts left, then right, circling, minutes passing, always a little closer, until the big bear charges again, little more than 5 yards, one heart-stopping lunge. The smaller bear stumbles back maybe twice that far, stands watching, shifting its head left, then right, not quite looking at the other bear. The big bear stares bloody-faced, eyeing the smaller, and from above, ignored, the cow moves down the hill, closer to her calf, as if there were still something she could do, something she could save. The big bear swings its head around to watch her. The cow keeps coming, moving gingerly, lifting a foot forward, reaching, then pulling it back, then forward again, touching the ground, then lifting her foot back up like a cat testing water. She calls and the bear watches, letting her get a few steps closer before breaking out in yet another charge, up the hill toward her, 3, maybe 4 lunges, covering 10 or 15 yards in an instant. The cow skitters back, but no farther than she'd originally been. She calls. The big bear turns, ambles back down behind the black log, lowers its head. Its shoulders bunch as it pulls at something. Its head rears back, jaws opening, closing. The smaller bear circles in, watching, unable to move closer, unable to give up. The cow calls. I watch for maybe 20 minutes, lying down behind the ridge crest, hidden. The action repeats itself like an endless loop. The bigger bear pushing away the smaller, then the cow, then feeding, then starting all over.
And that's just one of the bear encounters you had during that month. You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Pete Fromm about his second memoir, The Names of the Stars, A Life in the Wilds. If you just joined us, you can hear what you missed online. mtpr.org is the place to listen on demand, or you can sign up there for our podcast. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Those 10 miles you walked every day for 30 days, you had to be hyper-vigilant. And there was something that you did that a lot of us do when we're out hiking, and that's singing. But I enjoyed your description of how you didn't really have a repertoire to call on.
Yeah.
Except I've never, for one.
I've never been much of a singer, not even in the shower. But when the boys were born, I started putting them to bed every night, and I would tell a story and sing songs. And most of the songs were ones that I'd picked up from my father. So they're not your typical bedtime repertoire. A lot of Burl Ives, Big Rock Candy Mountain, Fox Went Out on a Chilly Night, The Noble Duke of York, Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Only thing I could think of was the stuff that had been pounded into me singing to the boys for the last 9 years.
And I'm just thinking of how incredible it would have been to be hiking down a trail and hear the noble Duke of York coming over the...
Yeah, there's times you're definitely glad you're alone.
Among the stories in this book about grizzly bears' encounters and elk and working as a park ranger and a lifeguard in the desert, you did some poking around in your childhood, sort of looking for the place where you started, I guess, going feral is what you called it. You know, nobody else in your family does anything like this, and most people would not agree to go even for 1 month to watch some fish in the wilderness full of bears, much less seven. So you were looking for what makes you who you are. Well, what did you find?
That trying to pick one thread out of your life and like, how did I get to where I am right now, is almost impossible. Every time I thought I had it figured out, I would dig deeper. That sounds too technical. I would just write more, and it would pull up memories that I hadn't thought of in decades. And I think, oh, yeah, it started before that. Indian Creek, there's kind of a built-in story. A guy who doesn't know a thing goes into the mountains for 7 months, and then by the end of the book, you find out whether he survives it. And this story, with just a month in the wilderness, it took me a long time to figure out what's the real story here. And finally, my French publisher read a draft after I'd been working on it for 6 or 8 years, and he said, "Oh, you're starting to get it. Yes, you're putting yourself more into the story. This is starting to work, but we need more of you." And I just thought, you know, there's only one character in the story, and it's me. So what are you talking about? "Oh, yes, we see you taking your little walks, you eat your oatmeals, you get scared by a bear now and then, but we need to know what it is. We know that you have this wonderful wife, these two beautiful sons. So why do you keep going into the wilds? The French, what we need to know is how it is you have become so screwed up." And so then I thought, oh boy, in just one volume, this is going to be tough. And so it did get to be a search for that. And it started to go that way already. And I thought I'd had it. And he just pushed me to keep going. And when I was 10 or 11, my parents would take us on little camping trips. And they'd want to go on the ranger guided hikes and the campfire programs. And I just couldn't stand being part of the group. I wanted to find that stuff out for myself. And I was such a cheerful presence then in a family vacation that pretty soon they were just throwing me out of the car and saying, "We'll pick you up tonight, maybe." And so it was that kind of a journey for me, trying to figure all that out.
I liked the way you made a list toward the end of the book of this happened and then that happened. And you had the whole list, and you look and you go, if one of those things hadn't happened, none of this would have happened.
Right. You don't have to be looking for why do you spend time in the wilderness. If you look for anything in a life, it's just all so random. And, you know, if you take out one component, almost everything else falls down.
And the thing that baffles me is that we have no idea what's going on, and yet we just keep going.
Yeah, and you think it's going along the way you're planning it. I at least knew that almost my whole life has taken place by accident. I came out to Montana without a plan. A woman tells me about the Indian Creek job, and if I hadn't met her this spring before, I never would have heard about that job. I lied my face off on a job application and got a river ranger job in the Tetons, and everything that's come along has just been random.
And then you broke your shoulder and spent time with somebody who became your mentor.
Right. Tripping over the first baseman in a softball game. That's pretty hard to plan in your life.
You say that you haven't done much singing, but you obviously like music, because the title of this book, and I think some of your other books, have come from song lyrics.
Yeah, I do like music, and I'm also really bad at coming up with titles, so I just steal them instead. Night Swimming, REM. If Not For This is from a Dave Matthews song. this book, The Names of the Stars, is from a Billy Bragg song, and it's a song he wrote. His father died when he was quite young, and he wrote this song. You know, it was a tribute to his father. And in this book, because of the bears and thinking back to other mentors of mine who have since died, you know, mortality comes into it. My 6-year-old son asking, you know, do we all have to die? And do you have to die? When do you have to die? And it all. So the song fit in very, very well with the idea of the book. And then it just got to be a question of which line do I steal?
Do you remember those lines that you printed in the book?
Yes. Kiss me goodnight and say my prayers. Leave the light on at the top of the stairs. Tell me the names of the stars up in the sky. Tree taps on the window pane. That feeling smothers me again. Daddy, is it true that we all have to die? And that's the opening verse of Tank Park Salute by Billy Bragg.
I'm going to pause for just a moment to remind everyone that this is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Pete Fromm about his memoir, The Names of the Stars. So you went to the Bob Marshall Wilderness without your boys, and when you first got there, it was raining, as you said, it rained a lot. But let's just hear a passage that describes some of what you went through on your daily walks.
Okay. As I march, I work on math. 1 month out here. A 70th of Aiden's life, 100th of Nolan's, a mere 500th of mine. Maybe this is all something I should have calculated before. Indian Creek? Sure. I'd been 20, footloose, clueless, reading far too many Mountain Man books. What was 7 months then? But now? Missed the last of Aiden's kindergarten? Both their baseball seasons? I'm the coach, for crying out loud. I've been hiking 5 hours by the time I slip and slide down to the pack bridge, then claw and pull my way back up the ridge above the river for Spruce Creek. I'm pushing on my thighs, plodding, looking nowhere but at the ground, my next step. Heavy with water, my hood hangs as low before my eyes as a sullen teenager's hair. The drum of rain against it lulls me into something near a trance. 1 foot forward, then the other. I slog through the thick trees, hardly noticing their dark menace in the overall gloom, not making a sound, not a glance left or right. At Spruce, I just make the descent on my ass, a semi-controlled pinball off the clot of charcoaled snags. The eggs are the same. Pink, eyed, tiny. I have to look a long time to see one vibrate. No silt to swirl, I look back up the hill, pull myself to my feet on another tilted, blackened snag, and start the struggle up the mud-racked, burned, and broken slope. Reaching the top, I hunch over, hands on knees, sucking air like a wounded marathoner. Soaked with rain and sweat, globbed with mud and smudged black from the sodden charcoal of the snags, every line and crease of my hands etched sooty from grabbing and pulling myself up and over them, I hang my head, feel the charge of my pulse. I've walked maybe 10 miles. 10. I'd left the boys to wear myself out in nothing more than 10 miles. In the 25 years since Indian Creek, have I grown nothing but old? I straighten, push my hood back enough so I can see, no trace of sun, the clouds only feet above me, thick and heavy as wool, and there in the trail I stare down at a grizzly track, stark in the mud, covering my own boot print, a whole series of them, a quiet amble up the river, right behind me, middle of the day. I turn, look back, out into the rain, my gut tightening. I've been down at the river, what, 10 minutes? 15. I think of my mindless plod through the thick stretch and wonder just how much older I'm going to get. But can I really walk miles a day the way Lee had, shouting, "Hey bear, hey boo-boo," at every dark spot in the trail for the next month, clapping 4 or 5 hours a day, whistling a happy tune? Instead, wavery at first, but louder and stronger as the trail gets tighter and even gloomier, my view shorter, I sing. More limited than my talent, though, is my repertoire. Every song I'd ever heard driven out of my head by the repetition of the few bedtime songs I'd croaked out for the last 8 years. Entering the blackest stretches of timber, I belt out Fox Went Out on a Chilly Night, or The Noble Duke of York, or The Bear Went Over the Mountain, a natural. Mama's Little Baby Loves Shortening Bread, Take Me Out to the Ball Game. But still, there are bedtime songs, and I can hardly make it through them. Safely back into the burn, where I can see, I shut up, sliding down the greasy trail to the pack bridge. I pause halfway across, leaning over the rail, watching the swollen river tear along, a filthy runoff brown, fishing a long way off. I trudge on, my boots ringing hollowly on the planking, until I hit the mud on the other side and start the climb. I puff up the hill above the river, then drop into the last deep, dark, dripping forest, the Gates Creek waterfall loud enough to muffle whatever the rain doesn't, the bear's favorite trail to the river. I try singing the boys their songs, but my voice gives up completely, and I plug along, wiping the rain from my face with my sooty hands. A month here without them? I can't strangle out one more word. Let the bears eat me.
Your boys are grown up now. What are they, 19 and 22 or something like that?
Yeah.
Are they also crazy for wild places and adventures, or have they taken a different life path?
Both. My older son is just finishing up a degree in environmental sciences at Colorado College, and he's been a wilderness ranger intern for the Selway Bitterroot Frank Church Foundation. He's just now gotten off a three-masted sailing ship that he sailed from Samoa to Tonga to Fiji to New Zealand. And now he's got a couple more months in New Zealand just to back around before coming back to Colorado and finishing his degree. Well, as my wife says, this is all your fault. And my younger son didn't want to follow in his older brother's footsteps. So he can row down a river, but he chose to play soccer instead. And he's a freshman at Santa Clara University in San Jose as a business major. But there's hope. He's young. he may not be a businessman his whole life. So he has been out and in it all, backpacking, rafting, canoeing, and enjoys it. But really, I kind of admire. He says, "Well, I want to try the other side. I want to go to a big city." He did kind of break my heart. We hiked up the big hill in San Francisco, and looking down, it was gorgeous. You could see the bridge and Alcatraz, and the sun setting. And he goes, "This is the coolest place I've ever seen." And I just went, "Oh, that's so wrong." After everything you've seen, but it was new to him. So, you know, it's cool that he's given it a shot.
Pete Fromm lives in Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about him and his books and sign up for our podcast at mtpr.org. Also there, children's book reviews, poetry, and links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you piles of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.